and welcome to We Are History. I'm John O'Farrell.
And I'm Angela Barnes.
And this week on the most laughable history podcast on the World Wide Web, we are talking about La Bajada Cochinos.
Not bad, John. Not bad.
You gave me, I like the way you gave me the
Spanish. I know, I thought I'd put the Spanish bit in the intro for John to do. Lovely. I didn't learn Spanish, I only learned German and French, so...
The only Spanish I learned is teaching my daughter GCSE Spanish. We went on holiday to Spain and they left me to do all the ordering. They'd learned Spanish at school and I said, dos cerveza, two beers, un café con leche.
You bought two beers for your children, John.
Yeah, this is for me and Jackie. Café con leche, una Coca-Cola. And they were going, oh, una Coca-Cola. They were taking the piss out of me saying Coca-Cola in a Spanish accent. It's like, oi, you lot did Spanish at school. You should be ordering. Anyway, La Bahía de Cochinos is the Bay of Pigs.
Yes.
We are heading to Cuba.
We are. Have you been to Cuba, John?
I've been to Bar Cuba in West London.
I've been to Cuba.
Oh, I'm jealous. I'd love to go to Cuba.
I went to Cuba 10 years ago, 2011. Me and my friend Dave went to Cuba. And I loved Havana. Completely fell in love with Havana. We spent time in Havana and then we went down to this sort of all-inclusive resort called, oh God, Veradero, I think it was called, something like that. Anyway, where I got the worst food poisoning I've ever had in my life, to the point where I remember at one point just lying on the floor of my hotel bathroom, just thinking, how's my mum going to get my body home? That's how bad it was. I really thought, oh God, she's going to have to try and negotiate with Cuban authorities to get my body home.
That food poisoning was the fault of the Americans. I just want
it to say. Was. Let's blame the Americans. So yes,
I've been to Cuba, but this is an episode about lots of people trying to get to Cuba and having a mixed experience. Let's say so.
Well, you could say that.
Yes. So Angela, you're leading on this one with your love of Cold War drama.
My love of Cold War drama, and this is quite a lot of Cold War drama in this episode. So before we sort of get into the meat of it, I should say the Bay of Pigs invasion was a huge covert military intelligence operation. And like any of these, they involve a lot of moving parts, right? There's lots of people in charge of different departments who all get involved in different ways, and lots of different things in an operation like this are on a need to know basis. So it's really impossible to really know who knew what and when at the time.
That's the job of a historian, Angela. To sort of try and pull it all together.
You and I are not historians. We must remember this.
We're just history nerds.
That's someone else's job. So I read a book called The Bay of Pigs, which was by Howard Jones.
I'd like to get to know you well.
Do you know, Johnny also did a song called Things Could Only Get Better.
I wrote a book called Things Are Going to Get
Better. You did, I know. That's
but
why
I ripped
mentioned
off
it.
My title from a different song to the Howard Jones song. Let's just be clear here.
Yeah. I did rip it off from a song, just not
but
that
not
one.
That one, right?
Yeah, all right. So, Howard Jones, shut your trap. So, I do recommend the book. The book's really good, but it is a very detailed analysis of what happened, a way more detailed than we've got time for today, John.
Although, we'll see. We'll see, Angela.
This is an Angela Barnes classic we've got coming up. The problem is it is a really interesting story, and but there's so many things. It's like any of these things that end up, spoiler alert, slightly disastrous. There's sort of a sequence of events that had to happen to make it so bad, you know. And if you sort of miss out a part, it doesn't make sense. Anyway, you'll see. I also read a book that I've got called Cuba, A History, right?
Which I thought,
I'll have a little look at. Well, the thing is, this is a book I bought in Cuba.
Oh, no, it's not that one I read.
So I'll tell you what, John, it's ever such a little bit on the biased side.
You're saying they don't have a free press in this communist country.
Just saying, John, that if you buy a history book about Cuba in Cuba, it's a little one-sided.
Oh, I read a couple of modern histories of Cuba sitting in the library and I haven't got them with me, so I can't tell you who wrote them, which is a bit shameful.
Oh,
but it's a well-documented episode in history. How far are you taking us back? Cuba was formed when two tectonic plates merged in the Atlantic
Shelf. Take the piss.
All right, move forward a bit. Arawak Indians were displaced by the Caribs. So tell us about Cuba.
So Cuba, the Republic of Cuba, do you mind? Mm-hmm. Is a country comprising the island of Cuba and a few archipelagos, and it's located in the northern Caribbean, where the Caribbean Sea, the Gulf of Mexico, and the Atlantic Ocean meet.
Oh, blimey, you really are doing this.
The northern tip of Cuba, this is the important bit, John.
Yeah.
The northern tip of Cuba is about 103 miles from the southern tip of Florida. So it's very, very close to the United States.
Yes, of course, historically a colony of Spain.
Yeah.
Until the Spanish-American War of 1898, which is actually a very interesting war, and one I'd like to maybe do one day. Then, of course, Cuba was occupied by the United States. That's when they got Guantanamo Bay, actually. That's where they sort of, ever since then, they've had that. Gained nominal independence as a United States protectorate, I think, in 1902.
Yeah, and it's actually 1903 America got Guantanamo, as a little aside.
Okay.
And did you know, another little aside about Guantanamo. So Guantanamo is a region in the south of Cuba that is sort of, it's attached to Cuba, but it's sort of cut off because it's surrounded by mountains. So it's sort of cut off from the rest of Cuba. And the Americans have a naval base there and obviously a massive prison camp. Interestingly, since the revolution in 1959, which we'll come up against, Cuba has only ever cashed one single payment from the US for Guantanamo. So they lease it.
Oh, I see.
It's leased. But Cuba, because they claim it's an illegal occupation.
Right.
Because it was obtained through force and violence and threat. So they say it's a violation of international law. Anyway, you see, you're making me digress now, John.
Crack on.
It's be your fault this is a long one. In 1940, Cuba tries to strengthen its democratic system a little bit.
Yeah.
But there's a mounting political radicalization and social strife culminates in a coup and the subsequent dictatorship under Fulgencio Batista.
Ah, Batista, I've heard of him.
So he'd previously been president in 1940 till 1944. Then he exiled himself to the US for a bit. And when he came back in 1952, led a military coup 3 months before the democratic elections were due to be held.
Right.
Ousted the president Carlos Prios Ocasio. Yeah. I'm sorry for my
pronunciation. This is great.
Cancelled the elections and took control of the government, implementing what he called, John, a, inverted commas, disciplined democracy.
Okay,
sounds a little bit dictatorial.
So that's because of his dictatorship, of course. There was risings up against him, hostility to his how much he leased to the Americans. The Americans owned and ran about 60% of the corporations and land on the island.
Yep.
Not to mention letting the mafia do pretty much what they like. There's a whole plot strand in Godfather 2 about that which takes place in during the revolution and Batista and all that.
Hotel Nacional. Hotel Nacional was one of my favourite places in Havana. So it's this massive, beautiful, very sort of art deco-y hotel.
Yeah.
And it's my favourite place for two reasons. One, you can get a tour of it. So we didn't stay there because it was too expensive to stay there, but we went on a tour. And they show you round, and then they've got this one room that just has paintings of all the famous people that have stayed there. And obviously Sinatra stayed there and lots of it. But then on this wall is a little painting of Ken Livingstone. It's so funny.
Hilarious.
Hang on a minute. It's Ken Livingstone. And they've also got a nuclear bunker out the back, which we have two of.
So you had to go to that. Yeah,
big fan of Hotel Nacional.
Yeah. The most famous anti-Batista group was the 26th of July movement.
When was that founded, John?
I'm not sure, actually. I'll have to look that up. But that was founded by Fidel Castro, along with his brother Raul. And, of course, Che Guevara, the face of the
We've all had his posters on our wall in the university.
I wonder if Castro had a poster of Che Guevara on his wall. I don't know.
Probably.
It's like, come back for coffee. Well. Oh, well, this is going to be embarrassing.
When I first moved back to Brighton 10, 15 years ago, I rented a room for 3 months in this shared house. And the room I rented, the guy had gone to work abroad for 3 months. So I was just renting his room. His name was Dan, this guy. And so there was a plate on the bedroom door that just said, Dan. On it,
okay.
Right? Long story short, I started seeing someone called Dan, a different Dan. And of course, when I first brought him home, I completely forgot that my bedroom said Dan on it. And I brought him back and he just looked at it and looked at me. And I made it worse by going, I've been expecting you.
Anyway, tell us about the revolution of Castro. 1956, so, I believe.
1956 it began, indeed. The Castro brothers and Che Guevara had this group based on a clandestine cell system.
Yeah.
Sounds like a scientific description of an amoeba, but it's actually a way of conducting guerrilla warfare. So they had these cells of 10 people, each not really knowing what the other's doing.
Yeah.
But from his base camp in the Sierra Maestra Mountains, Castro starts leading this revolution from 1956. They recruit the people into an uprising, and they finally defeat Batista's armies. On 31st of December 1958, Batista resigns and retreats into exile. Castro chooses the lawyer Manuel Urrutia Leo I'm yep. sorry, to be president, while he and other members of the July the 26th movement take positions in the cabinet. So he was the prime minister.
Yep.
Immediately, John dismisses the need for elections. We've been here before, haven't we? Dismisses the need for elections, says we've taken over from the dictatorship
yeah.
to build a democracy in which we don't need elections, John.
Yeah.
Because our new administration is an example of direct democracy. So he said that if the Cuban populace have a problem, what they do, instead of showing it at the polls, they assemble en masse, John, and demonstrate and express their will democratically to him personally.
Yeah, it wasn't, of course, a smooth ride, was it?
No.
The US were not happy about this. This is the middle of the Cold War. The world is split into spheres of influence, and the Americas are very much the United States sphere of influence. There's all sorts of fascist regimes being propped up all across South America. And the CIA is making sure that it has control of the whole continent. So for suddenly this socialist revolution to happen on its doorstep does not make the Americans very happy. Is that fair?
That's fair, yeah. I mean, it's US also has a lot of financial interests in Cuba. They've got oil, sugar plantations, which they're keen to protect. So it's not just about defending against communism or potential communism, because it's not a communist state at this point. There isn't.
Right. And the Americans, they use oil and eat sugar, do they, the Americans?
Apparently they do, John.
Drive big cars.
Funny that, isn't it?
Eat a lot of sugar. One of the things about Cuba now is because of what happened, the subsequent trade embargo, is that all the cars in Cuba now are still 1950s American sort of big cars.
All the private houses in Cuba all have like a workshop attached to them, because they can't. Well, it's changed slightly now, and it was starting to change when I went there 10 years ago. But because there was no, you know, they weren't able to import cars, they just had to keep these 1950s cars going. And I mean, they look amazing. You sit on the wall in Havana, on the Malecon in Havana, and just watch these cars.
But
they're all held together with gaffer tape and a prayer.
Fantastic.
It's all these decayed Art Deco buildings.
Amazing.
It does look incredible, but it's also a sign of, you know,
a
really impoverished country.
Am I right in thinking that initially the United States recognised Castro's government until he legalised communism?
Their first concern was for the oil and sugar, and then Castro legalises communism. And as we know, US not keen on that ideology, especially not in their neighbours. Because what's happening, as you said, colonialism is breaking down across the world, right? So suddenly you've got all these countries, particularly in Africa, South and Central America, Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
And it's leaving a lot of new governments, these new young governments are coming up with the potential to align themselves to one of the two superpowers. Like you said, you've got the US and Russia, and most of these new governments align themselves with one or the other.
Yeah.
And so to begin with, it seemed Castro didn't particularly want to be a Soviet puppet, although it was a socialist revolution. They weren't buying into Soviet communism as such. And the Soviets initially needed Cuba more than Cuba needed them, really, because they saw it as a place to put their long-range missiles in the Western Hemisphere. You
that's
know,
not going to go well. That's a whole
it's
other
It's 100
podcast.
Miles from Florida. You know, you put a couple of ICBMs there and they're laughing, you know.
Yeah.
But what Castro does is he wants American influence out of Cuba, right? That's his biggest goal.
I think he'd launched the revolution on the slogan Cuba sí, Yankee no, or something.
No,
what's no in
no,
Spanish?
Yeah. Yeah, no,
Spike.
No.
Spike,
I like how you tried
what's
to
no?
say no in a Spanish accent.
I'm going to try that again.
It's Coca-Cola all over again.
Coca-Cola. Yankee sí. No, hang on. Cuba sí, Yankee no. I don't know what no is in Spanish.
Una
That's terrible.
Coca-Cola, por favor.
So then he began this whole sort of nationalisation program, and he was nationalising property owned by United States citizens, totaling $1.5 billion, I think it was.
Yeah.
He wanted the country's oil refineries, you know, which were controlled by US corporations, SO, Standard Oil, Shell. He wanted them to process crude oil purchased from the Soviet Union. But the companies were under pressure from the US government, and they refused. So he nationalised them.
Yep. So to retaliate, what does America do, John? America bans sugar imports from Cuba.
Dear.
Now, a huge chunk of Cuba's GDP at this point is from exporting sugar to the US because the America likes a bit of sugar. At this point, Castro nationalizes the sugar plantations and the banks and just about everything else. And so they basically push Castro into Khrushchev's arms, into the Soviets' arms, because the Soviets go, we'll buy you sugar.
Yeah, this whole episode is really an exercise in pushing Cuba closer to the Russian sphere, isn't it, really?
Absolutely. You know, everything the Americans do at this stage after the revolution just pushes them into the arms of Khrushchev. So the US was superficially was trying to repair their relations with Cuba. They held talks. Castro did a tour of America. They were trying to salvage the economic relations because they were making so much money.
Castro did a tour of America?
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
With a band?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Hello, New York. No, but they were also trying to persuade him to limit ties with the Soviets, obviously.
So we get to 1960. Eisenhower is at the end of his term as president.
Yep.
He's obsessed with the domino effect, the domino theory of communism, where one country goes and then the next country goes. Mm. But a very boring game to have chosen, I think, really. I think the Kaplunk theory would have been better. The buckaroo.
They all fall to communism all golf, at once. Yeah.
Eisenhower's vice president is Nixon, of course. No good podcast about him, Angela.
Yes, we do.
Their administration want to get rid of Castro, obviously, but how to do it?
Right. Well, this is the thing, John, because the key phrase in all of this that is going to keep coming up is plausible deniability.
That sounds like not being honest is what I was
covering your tracks, John, because the US legally can't just wade in and invade a sovereign state without provocation, or certainly not without provocation that is sort of sanctioned by the UN and international law. So just because they don't like the leader and, you know, they're not happy economically, those party poopers at the UN won't let them invade. So any covert action to get rid of Castro's regime or to topple the regime has to be done in such a way that links to the United States can be hidden. Mm. So especially any evidence that the president himself might be aware of what's going on.
Yeah, you know, we're in a time of Cold War. You don't want to trigger World War III by invading Cuba and they're saying, OK, well, we'll invade West Berlin or whatever. So they've got to appear to be peace-loving America.
Absolutely. We're at the start, you know, we're in a nuclear age now. And if you start an act of war, particularly at this point, you know, that could be the big one. So they've got to tread carefully. So you've got the CIA, Central Intelligence Agency, headed by Alan Dulles, who we've met before in a podcast. I think we met him in the Suez Crisis podcast.
Yeah, well, possibly. John Foster was his brother, wasn't he?
Yeah, John Foster Dulles was the Secretary of State, was his brother. Now, Alan Dulles has a bit of previous when it comes to getting your preferred candidates into a government. Ooh. So, for example, in Guatemala, 1954, the CIA armed, funded and trained a force of 480 Guatemalans to overthrow the democratically elected president, who was Arbenz, because he started to institute land reforms, right, which distributed property to landless peasants. Oh. And they thought that felt, John, I don't know, a little bit communist. Right?
I mean, it's like it's political crazy, mad.
And the reason that the CIA sort of intervened, John, was because of the fear of communism, and definitely wasn't because Arbenz had ended exploitative practices at the United Fruit Company, a company that Alan Dulles and his brother, Secretary of State John Foster Dulles, had links to. That wasn't it, John.
No, nothing to do with their association with the United Fruit Company.
Yeah, nothing to do with that, John. It was all about communism, honest gov. So they'd already helped to place a government in Guatemala that they were happy with.
Right.
And also Iran and many other
places. All over the world. I mean, all over the world. But particularly in the Americas, you know, the CIA would intervene to make sure that their preferred government stayed in power.
Yeah.
In March 1960, the CIA came up with this plan to overthrow Castro's administration.
Yeah.
And they put it to the United States National Security Council, where Eisenhower gives his support to this catchily titled Program of Covert Action Against the Castro Regime.
Yeah.
It's not really. It could have done better than that. It could have been called Operation Cigar Bomb or something, couldn't it?
But, exactly.
but as you say, you couldn't just invade Cuba. That would be a legal act of war. Yeah. So the plan at this stage just consists of like recruiting and training Cuban dissidents and exiles. There are genuine dissidents, people who'd been working for the Batista regime or people who'd lost land or whatever. They're all living in Florida and they're training them in guerrilla tactics so they can potentially mount maybe perhaps an insurrection and overthrow the Castro government. Maybe you might want to do that. Just as soon as US sort of decides who they do want in Castro's place.
That's it. Because they need to decide before they can topple Castro, they need to make sure they've got someone in place to replace him with that they're happy with, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Another strand to this story, and it's one we won't go into a lot of detail about because I think it's a whole other podcast maybe one day. But the CIA, sort of in tandem with these plans, has a plan to assassinate Castro.
Oh, yeah.
Now, it's a plan that Eisenhower was aware of, but of course the word assassination was never used, plausible deniability, John.
Yes.
So they'd use euphemistic terms like executive action.
Okay.
And in August 1960, actual members of the Chicago Mafia were recruited by the CIA to carry out assassination plots. So wow. they got the mafia on board. And essentially, in return, the mafia, if they managed to assassinate Castro, would be given a monopoly on all the vice activities in Chicago. Blimey. Methods that they suggested using to assassinate Castro included poison pills, an exploding seashell, and a planned gift of a diving suit contaminated with toxins.
Wow. Exploding cigar was one as well. That was
exploding
the famous
cigar. There were loads of...
poisonous pen. This comes out much later, doesn't it?
Yeah, it doesn't come out. There was the Church Committee in 1975, which was set up to investigate these CIA abuses, of which there were many. And they released a report called Alleged Assassination Plots Involving Foreign Leaders in 75. So that's when it all came out. But in 1960, Eisenhower directs the CIA to begin preparations for invading Cuba and to overthrow the Castro regime. So they're upping it a notch at this point.
So there's a CIA agent charged with overseeing these plans. It's Richard Bissell.
That's right.
Named after the carpet sweeper.
That's right. Oh, it is, isn't it? A Bissell carpet sweeper. My
it takes me back to student days, yeah.
Yeah.
So he assembled some agents to help him in this plot, many of whom had worked on the Guatemalan coup 6 years before.
Yep.
And during this time in 1960, Radio Swan began broadcasting on Swan Island near Cuba. Could break Castro's arm, Swan.
That was another one of their methods of assassination.
It was, yeah, get Swan to break his arm. And they were disseminating anti-Castro propaganda.
They're setting the ground for, you know, anti-Castro sentiment in Cuba. They start spreading propaganda and stuff. And the CIA begins to gather and train these Cuban exiles in Florida. Although they quickly realise that they have to move from Florida because... plausible deniability, John. Yeah. You can't be training guerrillas on US soil.
That'd be obvious, yeah.
So they moved the operations from Florida to Guatemala.
So I think it's probably a closer climate as well.
Yeah, exactly. So the exiles themselves, of course, are told not that, we're the CIA and Eisenhower is funding this. They're not told that.
Right.
They're told that the guerrilla training operations that they're undergoing are all funded by a wealthy private donor.
Okay.
They're not that stupid.
Right.
The Cuban dissidents that are being trained, they openly refer to their secret wealthy donor as Uncle Sam. They're in Guatemala openly talking about this. So even the Guatemalan press start printing stories about how the CIA are training Cuban recruits in Guatemala.
Yeah, so it's obvious. I mean, the fact that loads of Cubans are being recruited in Miami, you know, there's also people telling Che Guevara in Miami, you know, there's loads of, he gets to hear about this operation being developed. So it's not a great...
Yeah, it's a badly kept secret, I think, is the...
So they've named the brigade the 2506 Brigade, the 2506
Brigade.
Yes. That's named after the serial number of one of their comrades. You know what he was called, Angela?
He was called, John, Carlos Rafael Santana. Not that one.
Down, 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 down. Yes, Carlos Santana. Tragically, I shouldn't laugh because this guy died. Yeah. They named it because they started their serial numbers of the troops, not at one.
They
start with 2,500. So if they're captured, it looks like, oh, they've got a big army. Look, they've got, must have at least 2,500, because look at the serial numbers.
Yeah.
It's like when the internet started and you'd have visits to the website. You always started it on 10,000. So you'd had lots of clicks.
Yeah, that's right.
And some internet sites just had visitors, 6, you know. It's a bit sad.
It's a bit tragic.
So he died. This guy, Carlos Santana, died before, you know, going off and making those brilliant albums, slipping into a ravine. So they had some air crews who were trained by personnel from the Alabama Air National Guard. And they had these American planes, B-26s, about 24 of them, obtained from the US military stocks. And they were, how can we put this, sanitized to obscure their origins, i.e. they painted them up to try and disguise them to look like Castro's Air Force or Batista's Air Force. So quick paint jobs. Anyone speak Spanish? What should we put on the side of this? Aeroplano, Comunista.
John, they were Cuban. They could speak Spanish.
The blokes ever seen them like... What I'm saying was, it was a bit of an obvious paint job. It was like, oh, let's pretend.
Well, we'll
pretend this.
Yeah, we'll get to that. But yeah, okay. They sort of moved the guns on these planes and things to where they were on Castro's planes and tried to make them look as Cuban as possible. And then to create a navy, because they were planning an amphibious invasion. So to create the Navy, the CIA purchases these 5 cargo ships, right? And they purchase them from a Cuban-owned, Miami-based company. So that gives them plausible deniability because they're not US ships. The first four of the five ships, the Atlantico, the Caribe, the Houston and the Rio Escondido, were enough to carry supplies and weapons to last 30 days, while the Lake Charles had 15 days of supplies and was intended to land the provisional government. So the first four ships would come with the invading troops, and then the last Lake Charles would come with the chosen government to land them in Cuba.
About this provisional government, guys, you might be getting ahead of yourself there, is all I'm going to say. Without wanting to spoil what happens in Cuba.
Yeah, that's one step at a time, Americans. Come on. So the ships were loaded and they were sailed to Nicaragua to wait. The invasion force also had these two landing craft infantry ships, the Blaga and the Barbara J. Barbara J doesn't sound American, does it, at all? No. They're these two old World War II ships, and they were part of the CIA's ghost ship fleet, and they served as the command ships for the invasion.
So by October 1960, I mean, they'd had guerrilla infiltrations and supply drops directed by the CIA into Cuba before. They'd failed. So, you know, this was like going up a notch.
Yeah.
And the hope was, that's pretty much all it was, because there wasn't a whole lot of intelligence to support it, that they would ignite a larger insurrection on the island, and eventually the people would all take up arms against Castro's and Shea and overthrow them. So this whole project was based on the assumption that all the Cubans didn't like free healthcare and literacy programs and, overthrowing the corrupt American-backed dictatorship. That was their hope.
Exactly, that they would land and the people would go, oh, this seems like a good idea, and would all rise up. But Castro has a pretty sizable army, plus a lot of militia, a lot of sort of reservists, you know, a lot of civilians trained to fight. So it's all a big gamble, this, because if Cuba doesn't rise up, if they don't rise up against Castro, the mission's a fail, right? Now, I don't know about you, John. Have you got any alarm bells ringing yet?
I want to see which way this is going, Angela.
I think we should have a little break from this, because what I like to do, John, in true Barnsley style, is take a break before the invasion we're talking about even begins.
Okay, we'll take a break. Don't go away. Have a word from our sponsors, which we still have under this capitalist system, which we're going to overthrow. Welcome back to We Are History. We're talking about the Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961. Something else has been going on in 1960, of course, and that was the American presidential election. The candidates were Nixon, of course, who'd been the vice president under Eisenhower, and a young fellow by the name of John Fitzgerald Kennedy.
Yeah, now Kennedy's running a pretty conservative and pretty anti-communist platform.
Yeah.
And he's accusing the Eisenhower administration throughout his campaign of being soft on Castro, right? Which must have been really annoying for Nixon as VP, because Nixon would have known about these plans they have to overthrow Castro, but he can't say anything.
Yeah. So he's sitting there in the debates, he's going, why haven't you done anything about Castro? And Nixon goes, I want to say it. We've got this massive plan. We're training up these guys, but he can't say anything, loses the election.
And of course, their debate was the first presidential debate. So,
yeah. Well, first televised ones, I think it is. So, spoiler alert, JFK wins the election. He wins the Electoral College, but his lead in the popular vote is tiny. It's about 100,000 votes, I think, just 0.17. The smallest margin of the 20th century. I'm not sure if we count the 2000 election in that or not. But he's elected in November 1960. He's not inaugurated, of course, under the American system until 20th of January 1961. Mm-hmm. Eisenhower, in November and January, briefed him a bit on the CIA's invasion plans that he'd inherit, but he received a full briefing once he was president on 28th of January 1961. It's like, bang, on his desk. What about this for an idea?
Yeah. You reckon you want to be tough on Cuba?
Here you go.
Have a load of this.
It's in your intro now, mate.
Yeah. So the plan he was briefed on was called Operation Pluto.
Named after the Disney dog.
Absolutely. And it involved landing in Trinidad.
Trinidad?
Not that one, John. The one in Cuba.
Oh, okay.
Now, Trinidad was close to the Escambray Mountains.
Right.
And in the Escambray Mountains, at this time, there is a rebellion of anti-Castro guerrillas already grouped there.
Okay. Yeah,
gorillas, John, not gorillas.
Okay. I'm
not mountain gorillas.
So there's a load of gorillas in Trinidad.
Yeah.
Okay. Carlos Santana's playing. She's not there.
And Howard Jones has written a book about it. The idea of landing in Trinidad is it's really easy to get to the Escambray Mountains, so it provided an escape plan. So if the invasion went wrong, the brigade could flee into the mountains, join the other rebels, regroup, plan their next steps. So JFK approves this plan.
I approve this plan, as he said.
That's what he said. But the Joint Chiefs of Staff, so the Joint Chiefs of Staff are all the sort of top military personnel in the States. Remember, John, this isn't a military planned invasion. This is a CIA planned invasion,
right? The American Army,
So the military guys who have the experience of this sort of thing don't have any say in it, really. They get briefed and they get told what's going to happen. And they felt that, you know, these 800 personnel, which at this point they were planning to land at Trinidad, weren't enough, and that the risk of exposing the US involvement was too high.
Okay.
Plausible deniability, John.
Okay.
So they made, the Joint Chiefs of Staff made a three-day visit to Guatemala, and they concluded that the odds were about 85 to 15% against achieving a surprise assault.
Okay.
So
I think that's
good.
A bit optimistic, if I'm honest. I think it's like 100% not going to be a surprise.
Yeah, I mean, hindsight's a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
Because these preparations were well publicised that they were going on in Guatemala and now in Nicaragua as well, as the naval fleets arrived there.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're nervous, but it's happening now.
Yeah, wheels are in motion. JFK couldn't delay because Cuba is about to get a load of MiG fighter planes from the Soviets, pilots being trained by the Czech Air Force. So any delay could mean that only a US Air Force could go face-to-face with Castro's Air Force instead of these quickly, hastily painted planes that they've cobbled together.
Yeah, because if these MiGs arrive before they invade, they're screwed, right?
Yeah,
these 20 MiG fighter jets and these Czech-trained pilots come in with them, they're screwed.
So JFK's nervous, isn't he?
He's nervous about Trinidad. He's also nervous because there wasn't a big enough landing strip in Trinidad.
Right.
So that means it would be really hard to disguise that the air attacks weren't coming from Cuba, because they need it to look like these airstrikes are coming from within Cuba.
Like it's a rebellion.
Because that's the idea.
Yeah.
So if they start the rebellion somewhere where there isn't a landing strip big enough, that's going to look a bit dodgy.
Yeah, I think it's past that point, if I'm honest, Angela.
Well, I think what happens here, what we see here is a lot of, there's a lot of analysis has happened of what happens, and there's sort of this groupthink idea that seems to happen.
Yeah.
Everyone's just trying to please each other
and
not really looking at what is going to happen in
work?
The real world.
Is this going to work?
Yeah. It's the CIA don't want to upset the president. The Joint Chiefs of Staff don't want to upset the CIA or the president. And they're all going, oh, I'm a bit worried about this, but no one's really stopping it.
Right.
So Bissell, the CIA director of the plan, he proposes a new landing site at the Bay of Pigs. Now, the Bay of Pigs is chosen because there's two airstrips there that they can commandeer and make it look like the airstrikes are coming from within. What it ignores, John, this new plan, is that there isn't really an escape to the mountains from the Bay of Pigs the Bay of Pigs area where they're intending to land is surrounded by vast swamplands, John. And these swamplands are filled with alligators and crocodiles. And I don't know if you can see a problem with that.
Well, what I would have done, Angela, is I'd wait for the crocs to line up, like in that James Bond film, and then run across them.
A footpath.
Yeah.
Because remember, it's not just a case of just landing on Cuban soil. They've then got to get an insurrection going. So they've got to get inland. They've got to get across these swamps. And Jacob Esterline, who was the CIA project director, his quote about this was, how can such a landing inspire insurrection? Nobody was there except alligators and ducks.
Right.
So after some toing and froing, the Bay of Pigs finally is decided to be the landing site. They decide to reframe the problem of the swamps as a positive, because they're going to provide cover for the rebels, John. It's fine, because Castro's forces won't be able to get them. Be fine. And Operation Zapata replaces Operation Pluto.
Okay, that's a weird renaming, but never mind. JFK was also adamant that rather than do it as a dawn raid, the raid should take place under cover of darkness.
Yeah.
So that the US ships carrying supplies are back in international waters by daybreak. These rebels, they're all like recruited students from the...
doctors, farmers, students.
Yeah. Students don't all be up at dawn. That's like, that's no good. At least at the middle of the night, they go, well, they'll probably just party and keep going. So the plan that they'd been working on for months, you know, it was going to be near the mountains. It was going to be in the morning. It was going to be a certain number of troops. It's all got changed by the executives.
Something like 9 days out, close to and like we say, they can't postpone the operation because of Castro about to receive these MiG fighter jets, right?
Yeah,
so they've got to do it now or never. So D-Day's set. 17th of April, 1961, is going to be the day that the invasion fleet come in, that the amphibious landing happens. Now, an important part of the plan is that 2 days before D-Day, the brigade's air force, right, are going to send 16 bombers to attack Castro's airfield. So before the landing happens, send the bombers in, these ones that have been painted to look like indigenous craft, send them in, attack the airfields, destroy his air capability. And then on D-Day, they'll carry out more bombing strikes just to make sure. And the Air Force will provide air cover for the landing with fighter jets. Right?
Okay.
Thought of everything. So the brigade that are in the naval vessels, they sail to Happy Valley in Nicaragua, which is where they're going to launch the invasion from. Meanwhile, in Cuba, thanks to the CIA training of Cuban dissidents being one of the worst kept secrets ever.
Yes.
They're pretty sure an invasion's coming, right?
Yeah.
And the Soviets by now, they've supplied them with tanks and other weapons. They have an air force, not a huge one, but they've got several bombers and fighters already, all left over from Batista's government. Che Guevara particularly is sure of a coming invasion. So he starts imploring civilians in Cuba to take up arms. Right. Yeah. All of the Cuban people must become a guerrilla army. Each and every Cuban must learn to handle and, if necessary, use firearms in defense of the nation. Okay. So all these people that these brigade, this brigade that's coming in are hoping to raise an insurrection with, they're already being whipped up by Castro and Che Guevara.
So these are the people that the Americans were presuming would rise up against Castro. Che Guevara is confident enough to tell them to grab a weapon because he thinks they'll defend the revolution.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. On the 13th of April, Radio Moscow broadcast an English language newscast predicting the invasion in a plot hatched by the CIA.
Cynical.
Using paid criminals within a week, right? Yeah. So it doesn't come out much till much later that the CIA actually knew about this, but it's happening now. What are you going to do? So the Russians know the invasion's coming within a week, which it is. So the Cubans know. So this surprise landing.
Yeah.
Not a surprise.
Yeah. Now, this, I would say, this is very early in Kennedy's presidency. He only came in January.
Within the first few months.
And I think that Nixon had said to him during the debates is, you're not experienced enough or tough enough to deal with the Cuba and the communists. Kennedy's a man with something to prove at this point.
Yeah.
So it's all resting on this adventure.
Although, of course, John, none of this is anything to do with Kennedy or
the US administration. People,
none of this is anything to do with them.
Yeah. So if you believe that, if you believe that,
plausible deniability.
If you believe that, Angela, you're more naive than I thought you are.
So on the 14th of April, so this is 3 days out from the invasion.
Yeah.
The New York Times publishes a story outing the whole thing.
Oh, my God.
Right, saying, we've been training Cuban dissidents in Guatemala and they're going to invade Cuba. To JFK denies any US involvement in a potential invasion.
Yeah.
Just says, no, they're training themselves. They're, you know, I can't help what they're doing. Nothing to do with me, Gov.
Yeah, his speech is very sort of like, there will be no Americans invading Cuba. Oh, hang on, no Americans, you know.
So, yeah, exactly. So he's very careful what he says for plausible deniability. During that night, 14th to 15th of April, they planned to do a diversionary landing. So a sort of a fake landing to make the Cubans think they're landing somewhere else.
Where's that, Andrew? Is it some very difficult to pronounce name?
Baracoa Oriente province.
Ah,
let's say that.
Baracoa Oriente.
Yeah, something like that. That they're saying that 164 Cuban exiles commanded by Nino Diaz are going to land there. But the plan is aborted because when they approach, they see lights that indicate Castro's forces were already there. So at every step, Castro's forces seem to be ahead of them.
Yeah.
15th of April, important day, right? We're 2 days out away from the landing. This is the day of the proposed airstrikes, right? JFK decides at the last minute that sending 16 bombers is too much, right?
Oh,
and so to protect the, here we go again, plausible deniability as much as possible, he's only going to send 8 bombers instead of 16, right? And with a 9th bomber, now, this is the clever bit, John.
Yep.
What they've planned here is one of the bombers is going to go, look as if it's going to Cuba, right?
Yeah.
So then it's going to turn around and it's going to go to Miami from Cuba. So it's going to look like it's coming from Cuba into Miami, where it will request a landing. And the pilot, who is one of the Cuban dissidents, but now using a false name, he's going to say he's a defector. So this can prompt the international community into thinking it's a coup. Then the UN might allow intervention from the States at a later date.
I fled Castro, it says here on my script.
Yes. That's right.
That was the plan anyway.
It was foiled a little bit, though, John, when one of Castro's Air Force did defect.
Oh, disaster.
And what happened was his aircraft looked completely different to the fake defectors, as it turned out. The guns were in the wrong place. The livery was painted slightly differently. So it looked really dodgy.
So suddenly, like, really
these two
obvious
defectors from Castro, yet their planes are completely different.
But of course, because only half the bombers had been sent in originally, the airstrikes had nowhere near as much impact. So it absolutely didn't destroy Castro's air capabilities. In fact, they succeeded in destroying a load of planes that were mostly out of action anyway.
Yeah.
And JFK basically changed the whole plan that had been worked on for months. Half the bombers proposed, different location, different time. They should have just said, I'll tell you what, and we're going to invade Canada.
That's so, why not? Just, I mean, it's just everything at this point. Nothing is as the original plan stated.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah.
So on the afternoon of the 15th, so it's 2 days out. So this is the airstrikes have happened that morning.
Yep.
That afternoon, the Cuban foreign minister goes to the UN General Assembly and accuses the US of aggressive air attacks against Cuba.
Right.
And that afternoon, he formally tables a motion to the UN General Assembly.
Right.
And the United States ambassador, Adlai Stevenson, he's saying, well, no, US armed forces would not under any conditions intervene in Cuba. That's what JFK said. Mm. The US would do everything in its power to ensure that no US citizens would participate in actions against Cuba. And he also stated that the Cuban defectors had carried out the attacks that day. And he presented a photo of the fake defectors plane in the Cuban markings at Miami Airport. Right.
Right. Right.
So JFK backs him. Of course he does. He supports a statement made by Stevenson. He says, I have emphasized before that this was a struggle of Cuban patriots against a Cuban dictator. While we could not be expected to hide our sympathies, we made it repeatedly clear that the armed forces of this country would not intervene in any way, right?
Right.
And Stevenson believed that and later was really embarrassed when he realised that the CIA has lied to him and let him go to the UN and lie. Same day, the Cuban National Police starts the process of arresting thousands of anti-revolutionaries in Cuba, detains them in places like the Karl Marx Theatre in Havana, the baseball park.
The Karl Marx Theatre?
Yes, I know, a bit of a giveaway.
They were desperate to get the grant, weren't they?
Yeah. So between 20 and 100,000 people are rounded up and arrested on that day. We're still 2 days out of the invasion, John.
Wow. So JFK then decides that because it looks like he's going to get caught, he decides not to do the second load of airstrikes on the D-Day, doesn't he? And that will reduce the air cover for the landings. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, there's a couple of things going on here. So these anti-revolutionaries that Castro's rounded up, they're the ones that are likely to be the insurrection that the US need. They're all now imprisoned, right? So that chance of that insurrection happening, virtually nil now.
Yeah.
And then, JFK says, we're not going to send the bombers on D-Day either.
Right.
So we'll provide a little bit of air cover where the landings are, but we're not going to go and deal with the rest. So Castro's got his air fleet. It's there and he can use it.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're now going to be under threat from air attack when they land, right? Now, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the military guys, they're just ignored when they express concern. And the CIA feel they can't question the president because plausible deniability.
Right.
So it just all goes ahead, despite everyone going, this is a disaster.
They sort of know that before they even get going.
They just can't stop it at this point.
Wow.
That night, between the 16th and 17th of April, they'd stage a mock landing near Bahia Honda in the Pinar del Rio province.
Very nice.
They send a flotilla, right, with equipment which broadcasts sound effects of a naval invasion landing, briefly luring Castro away from the Bay of Pigs battlefront.
They actually fooled them then. That actually was sort of briefly, Castro thought, oh, they've tricked me.
Yeah. That was one of the only things that sort of goes right. For that brief moment on that night, they let Castro think that the invasion's happening somewhere else.
So D-Day comes along.
The Blagar and the Barbara J, the two landing craft infantry, each with a CIA operations officer and an underwater demolition team of five frogmen, enter the Bay of Pigs.
Yeah, and it should be said that these landing craft are not actually very much like landing craft. They're sort of like cobbled together fishing boats and trawlers. And so they're not particularly suited for...
Well, the LCIs they arrive on are old World War II landing craft.
Oh, right. But there's a load of people turning up on fishing boats. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the supply ships aren't up to much.
Yeah, they've got three landing sites, haven't they? Blue, green and red beaches. And then the idea is the troops would meet to form a beachhead. Is that right?
That's right. So they land in three sites and they all come together, form a beachhead from where they launch the insurrection.
Yeah.
Now, when the frogmen come in, right, so they come in first.
Yeah.
They're shocked to discover that the Red Beach lit with floodlights. Right. The Cubans are already there. The Castro's army's already there, which led to another hasty change at the last minute. alarm bells ringing any louder yet, John?
So the US spy planes had done a recce beforehand, and they'd seen loads of dark patches in the water. And they went, oh, that's just seaweed. Don't worry about that. That's seaweed. And people there go, you sure it's seaweed? It could be coral. No, it's definitely seaweed. But look, David Attenborough is making a documentary there. It's got to be coral. No, it's seaweed. Don't worry. You can land really easily there. And of course, they go and crash into this coral. Their boats can't get onto the actual beaches.
Yeah. So you've got one of the beaches they can't land on, so they've got to move.
Yep.
The other one's full of coral, sharp, dangerous coral. Ships run aground. Ding, ding, ding. There goes my alarm bell again. Right.
Yeah.
So you've got American supply ships holding supplies for this amphibious force of Cubans, the Brigade 2506, and they're starting to run aground in a coral reef. So landing the equipment becomes, they have to get it across the water. So a lot of it's water damaged, including their radios.
Yeah.
And daybreak. Right, now you've got three separate lots of people trying to get together with no radios.
Yeah, talking of radios, the Bay of Pigs has its own radio station in Cuba, and they were doing the breakfast show, and it's like, oh my God, all these people are turning up. So they broadcast that this is going on, so the whole of Cuba hears about it. As day breaks, it's like, oh, I was just going to do the traffic news and so a dedication to Auntie Jean, but no, I've got to look out the window, the army are turning up.
Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now?, the politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fern, guest Nikki McCann Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
So, yeah, they see this guy struggling to land on the beach, and the US ships are supposed to be heading back into international waters before daybreak. What happens next?
So they land. There's a few militias already in the area. Yeah. Brigade's able to overcome them. There's not that many of them. But before they overcome them, they've got on their radios and informed the Cuban armed forces of what's going on. So Castro's army's on his way.
Wake him up at 3:50 in the morning. It's like, oh, what the hell? I just got off to sleep at 3:15. And he goes, well, sorry to put you in a bad mood, sir, but there's been an invasion in the Bay of Pigs. The Bay of Pigs, that's all swampy. What are they invading there for? Oh, we have no idea, so it's ridiculous. So he puts all the militia units in the area on the high alert, and he orders in the airstrikes. Is that right?
He does. That's right. So 6:50 that morning of the 17th, one of the supply vessels gets damaged by bombs and rockets, kills 12 men. The rest of the men tried to get ashore, but they've got no equipment. And the Houston, which is the ship that's bombed, is carrying medical supplies, and they've all been destroyed. Ding, ding, ding. Alarm bells again. Now a brigade are landing with no medical supplies.
It's not going well.
Okay. It's not going well. Then the Rio Escondido, which was the biggest supply ship, they had tons of explosives on board, tons of airplane fuel. It was just a big bomb waiting to go off. And that's what happened. Takes a direct hit from one of Castro's bombs. It just goes up.
God, that would have been spectacular. You see, Americans have never made a movie about this, have they?
Funny that.
It's not big in American culture, but that would be a scene in the film. That would be the trailer, that thing going up. The only mention of it in American culture is that Billy Joel song. You know, it's like,
we can start
Dylan,
the fire,
Berlin, Bay of Pigs invasion. Yeah, but that's it. Yeah. That's it for American culture.
Funnily enough, they don't shout about this much, John. USA, Bay of Pigs. They don't do that.
They made a film about the invasion of Grenada.
Yes.
But anyway, at this point, CIA instructs the boats to retreat, doesn't it? Leaving the troops, of course. And they head back to international waters. It's like,
which is what they told, because they told them to head back in while it was still dark. But obviously they got, you know, it's all going wrong. So they stay there, and the CIA go, no, you've got to get out back into international waters. Otherwise we're going to lose our plausible deniability.
It's completely shot anyway. Don't care on,
Pepe San Ramon was one of the leading group commanders, one of the Cuban brigades. He gets on his radio to his CIA handlers saying, please don't desert us. And the CIA are like, oh, no, we're not. We just forgot our keys, so we're going to go nip back for them.
I've got my phone charger. It's like, what are you talking about? It's 1961. There's no phone chargers. Shut up.
Then by 11 o'clock that morning, Castro makes a statement on Cuba's nationwide network saying that the invaders, members of the exiled Cuban Revolutionary Front, have come to destroy the revolution and take away the dignity and the rights of men.
So the poor dissidents left to hold this beachhead and wait for the overthrow that they've been told their presence will ignite, whilst Castro is riling the whole country up to fight them, but they're stuck on the beach. Is that right?
Exactly. That's right. So during that night, of the 17th, 18th of April, the brigade come under repeated counterattacks from the Cuban army and the militia, air attacks, casualties mount, ammunition is used up, and the brigadistas, they steadily have to give way. Right? They just, they can't fight what's going on. It's clear by this point, no, this insurrection is not going to happen.
Right.
2 o'clock that afternoon, Kennedy receives a telegram from Khrushchev in Moscow.
Oh, that's nice.
Stating the Russians would not allow US to enter Cuba and implied swift nuclear retribution to the US heartland if their warnings were not heeded. So America daren't now.
Okay, that's not as nice as I thought.
Try and fix this.
I thought it was nice to get a telegram, but when you read it, it's like
sometimes
it's disappointing.
Telegrams aren't nice, John.
No, okay.
So basically, Khrushchev's saying, if you go in there now and try and fix this.
Right, it's going to be World War III,
mate. That's an act of war.
JFK agrees to send bombers in, doesn't he, with some fighter jet cover.
Yeah.
But the cover doesn't turn up because of time difference. Another one. They got the hour the wrong way. It's because they're coming from Nicaragua or something. So the bomber just gets shot down. It's like fairly basic stuff to make sure you're all at the same time.
It's just a complete comedy of errors. It's, we'll send bombers with fighter jets. We'll sort this out. And then they just fuck that up.
Yeah.
The bombers that were then shot down because they didn't have the fighter jet cover that they were promised, they weren't Brigade 2506 pilots. They were actual Alabama National Air National Guard pilots. They were American pilots now flying a bombing mission over Cuba.
And they got shot down and captured.
They got shot down and captured. Their bodies paraded as Americans, which they were. The US then denies ordering these American bombers. And they denied it, John, until the 1990s. They said that these were American pilots that had gone rogue.
Wow. So these poor families of whose American families of American servicemen who died over Cuba, they were told that their sons or whatever had gone rogue and betrayed their orders, in fact, are doing their orders and didn't get any sort of the recognition.
Well, there was one, Captain Thomas Ray. Castro recovered his body.
Yeah.
They finally returned it to his family in 1979, so getting on for a couple of decades later. And it wasn't until in the 1990s, the CIA awarded him the highest honour of intelligence, the Intelligence Star, which just doesn't seem enough somehow, does it?
For
decades, we've let your family think that you're a rogue, anti-American and all these things.
And,
because we didn't want to admit
he gave his life. He gave his life for his country, and he was they sort of stabbed him in the back. I love the fact that the CIA's highest honor is the Intelligence Star. It's like the lack of Intelligence Star might be the best thing.
Yeah.
But anyway, without the air support and they were short of ammunition, the brigade, the exiles retreated to the beaches, and they were mostly rounded up and captured by Castro's forces.
Yep. So
it's all over.
It's all over. On the 19th of April, 2 days after D-Day, at least 7 Cubans plus 2 CIA-hired US citizens were executed in Pinar del Rio province after a 2-day trial.
And then hundreds of executions took place, didn't they, in response to the invasion. So a lot of people dying here. He kept a load, though, didn't he? Because they were useful to him, these people.
Well, he captured and kept alive for 20 months, approximately... about 1,113 men.
Right.
9 of them did die from asphyxiation during their transfer to Havana. They were in an airtight truck container, so they died. But there's still, 1,000-odd men. And what Castro then did was use them as leverage, right? Because he proposed to exchange... First of all, bless
him. Hilarious.
I mean, bless Castro. Yeah.
This is so sweet.
His demands weren't much at first. He sort of asked for 500 large farm tractors.
And they go, mate, you can get more than that for them.
Yeah.
It's like... What, 600 tractors?
So eventually he sort of went, I'll have $28 million, please.
Yeah. So then on March 29th of March 1962, 1,179 men were put on trial for treason. And then by the 7th of April, so we're like a year on, they're all convicted and sentenced to 30 years in prison. And on the 14th of April, 60 wounded and 6 prisoners were freed and transported to the US. But the money, but then they were still valuable to the US, weren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. On the 21st of December 1962, so nearly 2 years later, I suppose, Castro and James B. Donovan, who is a US lawyer.
Not the singer.
Not Jason, no.
Call him Yellow.
Oh, that Donovan, yeah. No. They signed an agreement to exchange these prisoners, but not for the $28 million he originally asked for. By this time, he's upped it to $53 million in food and medicine.
That's hilarious.
This $53 million was sourced from private donations and from companies who then could negotiate tax concessions from the US government.
It's a bit more than 500 tractors. It's a bit more than 500 tractors.
Just a little bit more than 500 tractors. So what this does, of course, the Cuban people's respect for Castro grows. Not only John, and he's beaten off a US invasion. They got $53 million out of the imperialist pigs.
Exactly. So it's like suddenly the Americans have succeeded in turning Castro into a national hero. They've pushed Cuba further towards the Soviet Union, and they've been publicly humiliated on the world stage. Plus, the plausible deniability is completely short. Everyone knows it was clearly obvious it was over the CIA. And I suppose they thought we should never try to interfere with another country's internal affairs ever again, did they?
That's right. And US foreign policy has been completely sound ever since. Oh, wait, no, hang on. No.
Oh, irony
what
alert.
Actually happened next, of course, the failure of the Bay of Pigs means JFK, who's promised to be tough on communism, remember, that's what he got voted for. He's got to redeem himself, right? He's got to fulfil this promise to be tough on communism. So does that actually drive his policy in Vietnam?
And in the course of the Cuban Missile Crisis, which comes in 62.
So shortly after that invasion ended, Kennedy orders the Pentagon to design secret operations to overthrow the Castro regime. He persuades his brother Robert to set up a covert action against Castro, which known as Operation Mongoose, which included sabotage and assassination plots. So he's not going, oh, maybe we should leave this. He is full pelt.
Yeah.
Let's go back. Let's do it again. November 1961, the CIA Inspector General authors a report called The Survey of the Cuban Operation, and it remained classified until 1998.
Oh, what did it say?
Well, it basically said the CIA exceeded its capabilities in developing the project from guerrilla support to over armed action without any plausible deniability. No shit, Sherlock. Basically, it was all of it was way outside the CIA's experience and remit. You know, in Guatemala they trained up 480 people to mount an insurrection. This is an invasion.
Yeah.
It's a completely different thing.
Yeah,
you know, failure to realistically assess risks and to adequately communicate information and decisions internally and with other government principals. No one was talking to each other. No one was saying what they really felt about it. Insufficient involvement of leaders of the exiles. They weren't listened to. Failure to sufficiently organize internal resistance in Cuba. They hadn't riled up the people for this insurrection that they relied on.
Yeah.
They 100% relied on people coming to support them. Failure to competently collect and analyse intelligence about Cuban forces, poor internal management of communications and staff, insufficient employment of high-quality staff, insufficient Spanish speakers, John.
Oh, I didn't know. Who knew that they spoke Spanish in Cuba? I mean, that's, you can't expect it.
In spite of vigorous objections by CIA management to these findings, the director, Alan Dulles, deputy director, Charles Cable, and deputy director for plans, Richard Bissell, the carpet sweeper guy, they were all forced to resign by early 1962.
The incredible thing, though, is that after this complete catastrophe and cock-up and series of failures, Kennedy's approval rating increased in the first survey after the invasion, rising from like 78% to like 83%. It's like after Suez, like the Tories won the election. It's just the mere act of sort of being in crisis and trying to do something. Even though if you completely cock it up, it seems to increase popularity.
We're seeing that now, aren't we, here? We're seeing that with Boris Johnson now. Yeah. Like, spends a year fucking up coronavirus but because he was there leading us through a crisis, people say, "Go well, would you have done any better?"
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, the thing I'd say about this is that A, don't start wars and don't invade other people. But if you do, don't do it with one hand tied behind your back. Don't halve the number of bombers. Don't, you're not going to get away with pretending it's not you, so don't pretend it's not you. It's like the Suez crisis when Britain went in and then sort of went in half-heartedly and tried to do it surreptitiously. Exactly the same thing. No lessons have been learned.
I mean, what they would have been better off doing is somehow sort of provoking something from Cuba to which would allow them to then
invade.
But they just didn't.
But don't start wars, guys. Are people listening? Don't try this at home. Thank you, Angela, for taking us through the Bay of Pigs. It was a fantastic series of absolute disasters based on arrogance, misinformation, and sort of
the USA just assuming they're better than everyone
also,
else.
But also the Kennedy himself, new president, just coming in and changing plans at the last minute. Whenever I've been like on a big project and there's an executive producer who knows nothing about the project, they'll come in and say, no, I think we should do that. Dude, that just doesn't work if you do it like that. And they come in at the last minute and change it all. And it's just like that.
You feel you can't, and because you're the president, people don't challenge you.
Yeah. That's all from this week's We Are History.
Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at We Are History Pod.
Angela actually tweeted me and got my Twitter handle wrong
today. I did today. I put the wrong John O'Farrell.
Fantastic.
Damn it.
We'll be back next week with another gripping episode of We Are History. So thanks for your nice comments, which we enjoy reading.
We really do.
And we'll catch you next week.
Bye. Bye.